So I'd like to welcome you all to this session on providing web access to medical and health-related visual materials and archives. I hope you chose to attend this session because you have medical visual materials in your collection and perhaps a broad, diverse base of users who are requesting more and more visual materials online. So this session will be an opportunity for the three of us to share our personal experiences as archivists at three very different types of repositories with providing access to our medical visual materials over the web. I think it's become a commonplace to say that visual materials have traditionally played second fiddle to textual materials in archives. But it is true that until rather recently, visual materials have gone unacknowledged by professional archivists, if not categorically excluded from definitions of archives. But interestingly, some of the first attempts at creating motion picture and photographic archives emerged within medical institutions, beginning in the industrialized countries of Western Europe, principally France and Germany, and eventually catching on in American medical institutions. Photography and film were deployed, among other inscriptive tools, in the production of visual evidence for diagnostic, clinical, and research practices, leading to a proliferation of visual records at medical institutions. However, medical visual materials in many archives remain unavailable to the public due to privacy restrictions imposed legally and institutionally. This session will hopefully encourage many of you with unprocessed or unavailable medical visual materials collections to roll up your sleeves and work toward getting these unique materials available online. So for my presentation, I'd like to share with you the practical decisions that I've made and the theoretical background that informed them during the process of designing a plan for describing visual materials at the medical archives at Johns Hopkins for a broadening base of diverse patrons who never enter our reading room. These are our online patrons. They are students, filmmakers, academics, artists, educators, genealogists, physicians, scientists, business owners, historians, and other archivists. Some of them find our collections through Google searches or through citations in the professional literature. Others discover us when stories relating to Johns Hopkins enter the mainstream media. One thing online researchers of all types seem to have in common is an increasing appetite for archival visual materials. Just over the past 2 years, our reference requests for photographs and films have increased exponentially. And the overwhelming majority of these requests are made by online patrons, most of whom we are able to serve entirely through digitized materials over the web. I decided to talk about description within this session concerning web access because I believe it to be a central component of web access. It isn't only essential for user discovery of relevant materials and collections, but in the process of describing, we find and build relationships between materials that otherwise escape visual observation. More importantly, description allows us to provide an archival context for visual materials collections in terms of their unique circumstances of creation and organization, which is something we easily lose or obscure when we prioritize individual items for digitization. The context archivists provide through description becomes crucial for online research of archival visual materials, especially those creating within institutions in the medical and health fields, where the use of visual materials as evidence has a well-established tradition. But in this process of digitizing and providing web access to visual materials collections, I think some people tend to see archival description as somewhat redundant or less relevant. And I think the general idea here is that the most valuable information or evidence is embodied in the visual materials themselves. And thus, a small set of information is all that is required for the simple purpose of retrieval. Now, there's certainly nothing wrong with an online patron who just wants to see visual examples of a specific procedure or a photograph of a relative the year they entered medical school. But not all online researchers are coming to us with such narrow search criteria or that level of specificity. Many are engaged in research on broader topics that span multiple repositories, collections, and physical formats. Description is, of course, a process of naming and a process of selection, When we describe, we decide what to say and what not to say. Our many descriptive standards and rules developed in the library and archival professions have been remarkably successful in giving us a degree of uniformity and objectivity in our naming practices. But despite these professional achievements, description is still a very subjective process. And when we describe visual materials in particular, we have to become comfortable with the complexity of working within objective rules while making subjective decisions. So with all that in the background, we have to make decisions and implement policies to tailor our descriptive practices towards serving our diverse online patron populations. When I came to Johns Hopkins 3.5 years ago, I became aware of the medical archive's autonomy from the university's library system, its lack of institutional funding for IT support, its absence of a publicly accessible online catalog, and other circumstances within which I would have to develop a plan for description. Much of my first year was devoted to developing policies for digitization and metadata for an IMLS grant that we were not awarded, and working with our collections management archivist to migrate our legacy data from a heavily modified proprietary Windows-based database system to a web-based archival management database and online catalog powered by Eloquent Archives WebGenCat. Based on the institutional focus of our holdings and our various administrative requirements, I decided that a hybrid approach was required. Collection and multi-level description was most attractive to maintain descriptive control over extensive visual materials collections and to place them within their context as parts of larger collections of institutional records or personal papers. At the same time, some degree of item-level description would be required for digitized items, for retrieval, and for documentation of permissions. I decided that redundancy between the item-level and multi-level approaches should be minimized, but at the same time, I recognized the need for description to be coextensive to the level being described. At higher levels of description, which often encompassed multiple formats, the description would have to be broader and more generic. Also apparent was the fact that content standards for still images were not appropriate for moving images and vice versa. On an entirely practical level, I also needed to recognize that regardless of the descriptive level or content standard adopted, everything would need to be mapped to DAX elements for the data entry within our adopted archival management software. At the item level for still images, I decided the Library of Congress's graphic materials was the most appropriate standard. While the graphic materials manual was clearly developed in an era of marked dominance, it was relatively easy to map all the areas of graphic materials to DAX using crosswalks between MARC and DAX. Graphic materials has many advantages over DAX for describing photographic materials, including its guidelines for structuring supply titles and its tightly structured rules for the physical description area. In terms of presentation, I wanted thumbnails to appear in the public display for item level records whenever possible. The only cases in which thumbnails are not included are when images contain protected health information or unique rights restrictions. For images containing protected health information, the restrictions and provisions for access are indicated while the thumbnail is hidden from public view. In most cases, external rights holders are agreeable to allowing low-resolution images attached to catalog records with a provision that rights information be included in the record and that permission requests be forwarded directly to them. For deceased, unknown, or unavailable rights holders, the images are made accessible through the catalog under the reasonable assumption that this constitutes fair use. Here is an example of an item-level record for this photograph of George Guy in the Tissue Culture Laboratory at Johns Hopkins. For multi-level description, I decided to use DAX as it seemed more appropriate for complex and varied collections. To control the use of material terminology, I supplemented DAX with a list of specific material designation terms in the graphic materials manual. I also felt it was more important that photographic series within larger textual and multi-format collections reflect the same general language and approach as the rest of the collection to give a sense of uniformity in the overall descriptive style of finding aids. Photographic series within institutional collections are arranged to reflect provenance and function, while photographs in personal papers collections are arranged according to any original order that might be coherent during processing. Otherwise, these are arranged in chronological or tropical scheme that seems useful. For collections of unknown or mixed provenance, such as legacy visual materials collections that were arranged topically by predecessors, this arrangement is mostly maintained unless there are clear indications such as accession numbers or names that indicate photographs belong to other collections. Here's an example of a file-level record within the photographic series of the records of the Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing. The file consists of over 1,035-millimeter negatives commissioned by the Office of Communications for a particular recruitment brochure. The negatives arrangement within this institutional collection reflects that function. For moving images, item-level description is a little more complex. Description at the item level for moving images is focused more precisely on a Ferber-like distinction of the moving image as a work or expression of a work. This is a feature central to the content standard chosen, the Library of Congress's Archival Moving Image Materials, Second Edition, or AMIM-2. AMIM-2 was developed in the context of moving image archives engaged in photochemical film preservation in order to group all the original picture, sound, and composite film elements created in the production and distribution of a film, what the moving image archiving profession calls generations, in addition to new preservation elements created by the repository in the process of film preservation. This feature is especially useful for moving image collections received directly from institutional production departments, such as the film archives of the School of Medicine's Motion Picture Unit, which forms the bulk of the film holdings at the medical archives. This not only reduces the time required to catalog individual film and video items, it also reduces the number of hits for given work. Other useful features include its guidelines for documenting conservation procedures and its structuring for supplied titles, which also link records for outtakes and unedited footage with records for complete elements. Okay, and this is a record for the films of the 18th General Hospital by R. Carmichael Tillman. It's footage of a Johns Hopkins unit stationed in the South Pacific in India during World War II. Okay, for many of the same reasons I discussed regarding multi-level description for still images, I also chose to use DAX as the main content standard for describing moving images at the collection and series levels. And this is an example of our largest collection, the School of Medicine film collection, which is over 1,300 cans of film. Okay, I'm just going to briefly mention this because I want to run through these last couple of slides. These are examples of specialist and generalist concepts that are reflected in subject headings that you find in archival visual materials. These slides will be available on the conference site later. Okay. So another important part of descriptive practices is the application of access points to collections and items. Topical subject headings, authorized headings for corporate and personal names and genre form headings are the key types of access points that bring online users to collections. Medical visual materials embody many diverse concepts that are reflected in these types of subject headings, both medical and non-medical, specific and general. I found that the best way to use subject headings for diverse groups of online patrons is to use multiple subject vocabularies. I'm just going to run through these. There's moving image genre form guide, Library of Congress subject headings. Again, these slides will be available. Medical subject headings, UMLS, which is developed by NLM and includes MeSH, the source for graphic materials. Okay, I'm going to get on to a little more of the subject stuff. Okay, so using multiple subject vocabularies allows us to add access points for many different concepts. Okay, following Cutter's rule of specific entry, which basically says that you catalog an item or materials according to the most specific content contained in the item. So the problem that this creates is that, you know, potentially it creates a bias towards specialist users, especially with medical procedures and things developed in the medical professions. So one way to get around this is to use the hierarchy of the vocabulary in your database or your ILS or whatever you're using. And this is an example of the advanced search in WebGenCat where we can tag the broad term here and then click the consist of and you'll get hits on all the lower level terms. Okay, these are subject headings. These are going to be examples of subject headings that I applied to photographs and films. I'll just let you look at these. So this is Russell Williams and a nurse performing a thoracentesis. Nurses serving trays in a segregated gynecological ward at Johns Hopkins Hospital Women's Clinic. OK, Okay, you can see all sorts of different concepts are in these photographs that you can use subject headings to reflect. These are films. This is a surgery film, 1966. And Anna, her story, which I was hoping to have time to show, but I don't think I'm going to. So this is a sort of pro-animal research film that was done in 1951. This was shown on local television. Okay, and I just want to briefly mention our YouTube and Flickr sites. So there's YouTube and there's Flickr. And thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ginny Roth, and I'm the Princeton Photographs Collection Manager in the History of Medicine Division at the National Library of Medicine. I'm happy to be here at SAA and to be able to show you the images from the History of Medicine Image Database and how we use the web to share our collection with the public. On April 23, 2009, we launched our new image platform for the library's premier database, the Images from the History of Medicine, also called IHM. Today I'm going to give you an overview of the IHM and discuss its advanced features, which are meant to assist researchers in their quest to gather and disseminate information. Images from the History of Medicine is a database of nearly 70,000 images in the National Library of Medicine's historical collections. The collection of portraits, photographs, fine prints, caricatures, genre scenes, posters, and other graphic art illustrates the social and historical aspects of medicine from the Middle Ages to the present. Subjects are diverse and range from medieval medical practice to 19th century slum conditions to World War I hospitals to the international fight against drug abuse and AIDS. Several subgroups within the database are interesting as separate entities. A collection of 6,000 wood engravings of prominent European physicians purchased in Amsterdam in 1879 was the library's first graphic arts acquisition. There are illustrations from landmark medical textbooks, such as De Humani Corporis Fabrica, On the Fabric of the Human Body, a textbook of human anatomy written by Andreas Vesalius. Among the fine prints are several hundred caricatures on medical subjects by George Cruikshank and Thomas Rowlandson. There are patent medicine advertisements from the late 19th century and posters on contemporary issues such as AIDS, smoking, and illicit drugs. Due to NLM's origins as the Army Medical Library, a large portion of the History of Medicine Division's holdings has a military focus or influence. Many images were produced during wartime, U.S. Civil War through the Korean War, and include facilities, doctors and nurses, soldiers and other patients with various injuries and conditions, tools, techniques, and procedures, and medical transport methods. Public health, nursing, dentistry, pharmacology, and related fields are also well represented. About one-third of the nearly 70,000 images in IHM are portraits and group portraits in multiple formats. They represent physicians, anatomists, botanists, dentists, pharmacists, nurses, chemists, and others who have contributed through the centuries to medicine and the health sciences. Using software developed by Luna Imaging, the IHM now offers enhanced searching and viewing capabilities to its researchers, who will now be able to view research results in a multi-image display, download high-resolution copies of images, zoom in on image details, and move images into a user-defined workspace. This slide shows you the IHM homepage that includes a link to the IHM database, as well as links to searching and browsing tips, information about ordering images, the NLM policy on how to obtain copyright permissions, information about the IHM, answers to frequently asked questions, and who to contact with reference questions. This is the opening page of the IHM, which is also the Browse All screen, which I will explain in more detail in a little bit. And now I'll give you an overview of the IHM features, all of which can accommodate users ranging from the most novice to those at a more technical level of expertise using the web. To search for images by keyword, you enter a search term in the search box located in the upper right-hand corner of the screen and click the search button. The search engine will retrieve images that have the keyword entered in any of the fields in the bibliographic data record. Multiple search terms are automatically combined together using the Boolean operator AND. To expand or narrow your search, you can also use the Boolean operator OR. You can add the phrase public domain with the search term if you only want to retrieve images that are in the public domain. If you look above the first row of images, you will see a set of page number links and icons. The last icon is called the sort options icon. You click on this option to sort by any data field in the bibliographic record. You use drop-down menus to select up to two sort options. The default sort is by relevance. For more technical users, the IHM offers an advanced search option that allows researchers to perform complex searches, such as truncation, using any data field in the bibliographic record. You first select a data field to search, and then select the type of search you want to perform, which include equals, starts with, and similar to. In addition to keyword searching, you can also browse the collection by choosing the Browse All option from the menu bar, which is also the opening page of the IHM. Unlike the previous IHM, where you were required to enter a search term to browse images, the new IHM allows you to browse all nearly 70,000 images in the database without entering a search term. You can view page by page or narrow your search using the panel on the left side of the page. The narrow search box lists the most frequently used terms in the database in the categories what, where, and who. The page reveals the top five most frequently assigned terms in each category. To see a list of all terms in a category, you click on the Show More link in that category. To see all images that have a particular term in their bibliographic record, you click on that term. Results always display as thumbnails. On this screen, you have an option of further narrowing your search by clicking on additional terms in the categories, or by expanding your search by removing previously selected terms. If you don't want to browse images without a jumping-off point, you can browse categories, which are the most frequently entered names, places, and subject terms in the data fields of the bibliographic records. Only terms that are used five or more times in the database will display under the categories what, where, and who. What terms contain topical subject terms, including mesh, physical formats such as portraits and posters, and the names of people who are the subject of an image. Where terms include both geographic subject terms and countries of publication. Who terms include the names of people and corporations who are responsible for creating or publishing an image. The terms are also listed alphabetically in each category. The number in parentheses after each term shows how many times a term has been used in the database. To view all images that have a particular term in their bibliographic record, you click on that term. Alphanumeric links at the top and bottom of the page are other options to browse terms in the categories. What, where, and who categories that begin with that letter or number? Click on the other category to see all search terms that begin with a special character, such as a quotation mark, parentheses, or a square bracket. All image results display as thumbnail images in the Browse All screen. There are three main options for viewing images in the new IHM. You can view multiple thumbnail images when browsing, which you've already seen an example of. You can view multiple images in the workspace, or you can view individual images in detail view. These two options I'll show you shortly. While browsing thumbnails, icons above the images allow you to set your viewing preferences. Use the items per page icon to view 50, 100, or 250 thumbnail images per page. Use the thumbnail size icons to resize thumbnail images to small, medium, or large. Bibliographic information is available for every image in the IHM, and there are two ways to view this information. You can scroll over a thumbnail image for a media summary, which provides the image title and the order number. The image title and order number also appear below every thumbnail image. To view the complete image record, click on a thumbnail to view the image in its detailed view. The media information window provides full bibliographic information about the image. In addition to the title, publication, and creator, the data record also includes image format, the file name, the height and width of the image in pixels, and copyright information. In the new IHM, images are no longer watermarked. Note the difference in image quality, viewing the comparison on the screen. A survey of the collection found that approximately 80% of the collection is likely to be in the public domain. The library has determined that release of unwatermarked images of materials that may still be under copyright is within fair use and part of its mission to advance knowledge. The workspace is a place for viewing and organizing images. Viewing tools are built into every image, allowing you to work with multiple images simultaneously. Researchers have the ability to move images within the workspace, zoom in and out of images to see an image's finer details and read small text, move images inside of the built-in frame, and show or hide a thumbnail navigator. You can also view the bibliographic information for every image in the workspace. All images in the IHM can be downloaded to your hard drive. You simply click on an image that you want to export, which will put the image in detail view, then click the export button. Images all download as zip files for fast file transfer. The IHM offers a printer-friendly format should you want to print out your search results or the bibliographic data for an image. All you have to do is click on the image to open it in detail view and then click the printer-friendly button located above it. What you're seeing on this slide is the print format of an image in detail view. Similarly, on the Browse All page, click the printer-friendly button at the top of the page, and this slide is showing you the print format of thumbnail images. Two dynamic features of IHM that I would like to point out are embedding and sharing. These options are always available on the main menu bar. Embed This allows you to create an embeddable web widget that you can add to blogs, forums, and wikis. For example, you can share search results, slideshows, presentations, your workspace, media groups, and detailed views of your favorite images. Share This provides a unique URL for the current page so that you can paste the link into an email or into an instant message. Registration is an option if you want to use some of the dynamic features. With a user account, you can create media groups to share images, search external media, and create presentations. Registration is not required, however, to conduct keyword or advanced searches, to browse images, or to use the workspace. Media groups are groups that you create using specific images of your choice. To create a slideshow, add external media from Flickr, share with friends using a unique URL, create a PowerPoint or Keynote presentation, or embed into a web widget for use in a blog or wiki. This slide shows a media group called Caricatures that I created with five images that I selected. You can add images to your media group at any time in the browser detail view, and they can be made public or private. The external media search feature allows you to search for public images on Flickr and add them to your media group. Recently, the History of Medicine division set up a site on Flickr in order to reach a new audience of users. Researchers will find sets of images including photographs, posters, postcards, book illustrations, and portraits, and soon the collection will grow to include special topics such as smallpox. All HMD images on Flickr are in the public domain. You can create slideshows, PowerPoint, or keynote presentations using the images in your media group. You add images from your media group into slides by dragging and dropping the images into slides. You can view the presentation as a slideshow or export it as a PowerPoint or keynote presentation. And finally, we have a full list of answers to frequently asked questions available from the homepage to help users navigate the site and understand the features. Thank you.
morning. My name is Paulina Ileva, and I wanted to start with a visual material, but it's taking time to open. So I work at Legacy Tobacco Documents Library at UCSF, and I'm in charge of the multimedia collection.
Oh, have a candle with your coffee. Thanks. But a camel's always a pleasure.
Yes, folks, the pleasing mildness of a camel is just as enjoyable to a doctor as Edison were asked, what cigarette do you smoke, doctor? The brand named most was Camel's. Tens of thousands of doctors, general practitioners, surgeons, specialists, doctors in every branch of medicine were included. And according to this nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Try Camels yourself, the cigarette so many doctors enjoy.
Well, paraphrasing a commercial from Virginia Slims, we come a long way from the time when we had cigarette commercials and doctors advertising cigarettes on TV. So that was a commercial from Camel from 1950s. And at LTDL was launched in 2002, and right now it has more than 11 million documents, about 60 million pages, covering advertising, marketing, manufacturing, and research aspects of the tobacco industry. The multimedia collection was added in 2006, and right now we have about 7,600 video and audio recordings. So we provide a permanent repository for documents and audiovisual materials that were opened through litigation and a master settlement agreement of 1998. So what do we collect? We collect materials that are currently in Minnesota Depository in Minneapolis and Guildford Depository in UK. Both depositories were set up through master settlement agreement and will be closed in about a year or two. We also collect materials that are in Roswell Park Cancer Institute and from Smokeless Tobacco Corporation. So what do we know about people watching a video online? As of January 2010, more than 32 billion videos were viewed on the internet, and 178 million U.S. internet users watch online videos. So how can we make all our audio and video recordings available to users? Because we don't have a reading room. Everything we have is online. Or in our case, in our vault for audiovisual materials. So we created a partnership with the Internet Archive that provides free access to collections in different formats. But do we have a copyright to all these video and audio recordings? Well, in our case, we don't own the copyright. All tobacco companies own the copyright to these materials. So we just provide a digital repository for them. However, we decided to use a fair use doctrine of the Copyright Act and the right of public to know to provide access to all these materials through the Internet Archive. Almost all the items are on VHS tapes or audio cassettes, so we do reformatting and digitization through vendors in Minnesota and London and New York. And newly digitized video materials are mostly in MPEG-2 format. So what archivists can do on the Internet Archive? As you can see, we can spotlight an item and you can change that item as soon as you want. You can provide an overview of your collection, do add some branding to your site, like you can see the Legacy and UCSF library logos. And Internet Archives provide a list of most downloaded items, for example, for the last week, last month, and for the whole collection from the time it was created. like here. You can also see new additions, like in Just In, and recently reviewed items. And as you can see, the most downloaded item in our archives are Virginia Slims commercials. You can easily add metadata, and you can even customize the fields for your metadata. Here you can see highlighted description for one of the items, and also highlighted the keywords for the same item. And you can add the link to the main web page. In our case, it's under credits. So here is one of the items on our main web page on LTDL. And you can see in the access there is a UCSF link. And when you click on that link, you will go to that page on Internet Archive. So it's the same page for the same page for the same item, but on the Internet Archive. So what we can say about interaction with users, we do have a forum, but it's not very active. But visitors can post unsolicited reviews, and we do have quite a lot of them. Right now, about 100 comments. They are mostly anonymous, so people use screen names. And following the so-called 99-1 rule, then 90% of people visiting your site are just lurking on your website, meaning not posting any comments. 9% post from time to time, and 1% are heavy posters. So in our case, we have about 45 comments that were posted by heavy users. So I would say we have about 10 really heavy users who post 5 or more comments. So as of July, we have 1,364 items. We have 100 reviews, and 57 items were reviewed. So I would say that a little bit more than 4% of items were reviewed. So why people review the items online? I won't read the whole thing because I will post my slides later on SAA website, but three more common reasons that videos help understand historical context. People are interested in music singers or actors in our commercials. And sometimes, but not very often, unfortunately, educators share ideas how videos can be incorporated into teaching process. What are the obstacles working with the Internet Archive? Sometimes uploading can be very slow. When mistake is made, it can take about a week to correct it. And if you have some copyright issues, it can be an obstacle as well. So what are our stats? As of last week, we have more than 1,400 video items online. And as of July 2010, our items, video items on the Internet Archive have been downloaded and streamed over 360,000 times. And here are the stats for 2008-2009, and you can see the difference. I think it's because more and more people are using online video and becoming familiar with our collection. I also did some stats of referrals from the Internet Archive to our collection, and in about 3 years, we got 5,600 referrals from the Internet Archive to the main LTDL website. So the results, working with the Internet Archive, first of all, it provides us a venue to show and post our videos. It facilitates reference process as well as outreach and publicity. And it created a venue for our so-called niche collection to be discovered by general public and researchers from diverse fields, not only medical students and medical researchers, but we got some requests from linguists and people doing research on usage statistics. So will users find us if we are just on the Internet Archive? Kevin Kelly, who was one of the first editors for the Wired magazine, recently said that moving images are the center of the culture. And if people have questions, they, himself included, head first for YouTube. So why use YouTube? Five things that people mostly associate with YouTube. It's fun, it's viral, hip, there is a copyright infringement, it can create or destroy the reputation of a brand. So why do we use it? Why do we think about using it? Archival users are there for outreach and promotion, crowdsourcing for metadata, and discovery for new audiences. What is YouTube? Well, I guess most of you now know that it was created in 2005. Now Google owns it, and you can easily share your videos through it. And you upload your videos to channels. So we created our channel about a year ago. Right now we have five videos there. They are a compilation from our commercials and focus groups. Because we don't own the copyright to our videos, we decided to create compilations with short clips from the videos. What kind of metadata you can provide? There are no limitations on the amount of metadata that you can provide. So you can provide title, description, tags, links to your videos on your main website, and you may control privacy, comments, embedding, and video responses. What are the issues? The issues are inappropriately related videos that are associated with your main video. In our case, we got videos promoting tobacco products, and unfortunately, you don't have control over what kind of videos will be listed in related videos. You can write to Google, but I tried that twice, but we don't respond. So you may try flagging these videos as inappropriate. We also get inappropriate comments, but it's easier to deal with them. You can either remove them or flag for spam. There are some interesting new features on YouTube. You can now add annotations, same as on Flickr, like speech bubble notes, spotlights. You can invite others to add annotations to your videos. You can add captions or request machine captions. And that's what I did in this case. And here I even requested a translation of that caption into Russian. It's not accurate. I would say it's 65% accurate. English machine captions are much more accurate. I would say maybe 80%. But it's just the beginning, and I think it's a great feature and will help us. What you can do, you can download captions with time code, edit it, and upload again. So it definitely will help us in our archival work. So what are the stats? You get the stats through Google Insight. In our case, we get number of views, discovery. In our case, it was discovered through YouTube search or related videos. Demographics for this collection, it's 87% male, and community is coming mostly from US. So what are the what is the assessment of YouTube use? It requires commitment on the part of the archivist to create, to respond to reviews and answer questions. May generate more requests for copies or uploads. You have to deal with inappropriately related videos. Sometimes you get offensive reviews or requests, and you have to deal with them as well. One unexpected thing, we wanted to promote decreased tobacco use, but smokeless tobacco videos became very popular with smokeless tobacco users. However, when you read comments, about half of them are from people who are quitting or encourage others to quit. YouTube also helps promote your collection and your institution. So as of last week, our videos have been viewed about 41,000 times. We have a blockbuster, Smokeless Tobacco videos were viewed 39,000 times. And in about a year, we got more than 180 unique visits or referrals from LTDL to LTDL from YouTube. We have about more than 100 comments. So our future plans, we may add more favorites from similar collections or institutions. We may create enhanced channel like Library of Congress through youtube.edu, use it for crowdsourcing, and let users repurpose our videos creatively, and we already have some samples of that. So as you can see, I did a comparison of YouTube and our Internet Archive, and the difference are in audience. Metadata, Internet Archive, and Internet Archive, it can be tailored for archival purposes. But otherwise, it's easily discoverable, and you get different reviews for Internet Archive. It's mostly about music, danger of smoking, people share experience, related to commercials, and on YouTube it's about tobacco, smoking, quitting, and some of the reviews are related to health concerns. Uploading is easy, and stats are easier to get through YouTube. So what we have a physical collection on our UCSF library. We have metadata for our items on LTDL website, provide access from the Internet Archive, and use YouTube for promotions. So what are the plans for the future? Upload the whole collection online, and use reviews for collection development and metadata creation and description. Thank you.
Okay, so we have just a few minutes for questions. Anyone? Okay, so the question was, have there been any requests from copyright owners to take down the videos?
No, we didn't have any requests, and I think tobacco companies know that it's in, you know, for public discovery, so nobody complained so far.
Any other questions? Yes. Okay, so the question was basically, if I understood it correctly, dealing with restricted photographs and, you know, visual materials, what is the policy of not showing the image, but do you account for having the image, I guess? Well, what we do is we expose the metadata on the images. So this can be at the collection level or at the item level, but we describe what is there. You know, you say what kind of print it is, and, you know, do all the same description. You just don't show the thumbnail. So they still can search the catalog and find that record. And then in the rights and restrictions area, it says, see the archive's policies on providing access, getting access to restricted materials. And we have a lot of policies on our website about how you can access restricted materials. Yeah, if they go through the process, through the privacy board waiver process, or there's a few different access modes of access, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Oh, in the back, Diane. Okay, so Diane's question was, basically what was the development process for all the different bells and whistles for the National Library of Medicine catalog?
A lot of what you'd see on the website are the more requested images from the collection based on researchers. And the items that we're adding will also be primarily from our exhibitions that are not currently on IHM but are online on the site. So users right now would not necessarily know how to access them, but once they're on IHM, because they're relevant and because there's already access, users will already have access to them, we're going to make it easier for them to access these items, which perhaps right now they may not know how to obtain, except to download a lower resolution image. So what you're seeing then on the site are highly requested images from the physical collection.
Okay, so the question was, how did Ginny decide what the target audience needed?
We wanted to have a site that had some very basic functionality, but then had advanced functionality for users that wanted to share information. Our old IHM, there was no ability for users to make their discoveries accessible to other researchers, basically. So the features that we have on the site are for researchers to share their discoveries, and what we have up there, which is also available from Luna Imaging, are features that allow you to make discoverable what was previously not discoverable, which is why we have Share This for you to send links to, say, slideshows or media groups that you've created, and why you can have a website and embed a widget. So some of the more advanced users who can learn how to use these features and who register with the site can use these to share with other researchers what they find. From what I understand, it was from what the system had available, but that's why they went with this particular system, because they had those discoverable features which other systems just do not provide.
Question was, how many registered users do this?
That's a very good question. I actually don't know, but I can follow up on that. Sure.
Any other questions? Okay, so the question was the subjectivity of choice of subject headings. Well, basically, it's what you come up with. It's very, very subjective. There are guidelines that are published by people like the Library of Congress for using the Thesaurus for Graphic Materials, for example, and they do, they are very tight vocabularies, and they have very specific instructions on how to use them and when you don't want to use specific terms. But at the end of the day, it's a very subjective decision, and you have to make sure you're being inclusive, and you're also, you're looking at that objectivity, but you're making the subjective decision, and you're aware of the implications of the decisions you make and choice of subject headings. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. How archivists describe materials and how we use subject headings is very much a product of our own time and our own experiences. So I think, you know, we do keep in mind potential uses of the documents and the visual materials when we come up with subject headings. I think that's important. But at the same time, like you say, it's very much a product of how we view, you know, society generally.
And I wanted to add to that. In our case, for our materials for metadata, we're using thesaurus that was created for visual materials of tobacco control, collection. But I'm also adding metadata about persons that were mentioned in the videos or audio recordings. But the thing is, we're using information that was provided by tobacco companies. Sometimes I can recognize people, especially in the older commercials, like actors, baseball players. But then, because of the funding restrictions, sometimes I just don't have time to look for that long at a particular video or listen to the whole audio recording. So that's why we would like to use, the power of people, users of our collection, and do some crowdsourcing to collect information about all the baseball players, actors that were, that they can see in our videos. And sometimes I do get reference questions asking me where can I find such a person, because they remember that there were some commercials, with such and such actor. So I think in this case, Internet Archive can be of, and even YouTube with annotations will be a big help for us.
Yeah, and I just want to kind of follow up on that a little bit as well. Annotations also happen, potential annotations also happen during the reference process. So if you have people using visual materials, oftentimes they will add information about them that you were not aware of that you can then annotate your records. Go ahead. Yeah. Yes, so this was just a comment on legacy descriptions and their inaccuracies, and do you go back and change them and all that sort of thing. Luckily, at our particular repository, there is very little legacy description in terms of visual materials, so I didn't have to worry about that as much. But you're right, and I think also it's kind of interesting that if you look at descriptions of like films in older film catalogs, the description is very much a product of its time. And that's part of the archival context that you can provide, is how the films were originally used and how they were promoted in their original context. So legacy description can be useful and it can be not useful. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, everyone. Do I have time to show a 3-minute movie? Yeah? All right. Great. We have 20 minutes? Really? Oh, awesome.
I had no idea.
Apologize for these audio issues. If there are more questions after this, feel free.
This laboratory research dog. She has done more for humanity than many human beings. Anna was used to develop the first operation to cure blue babies. Here is Michael Shermer, 2412 East Lafayette Avenue, Baltimore. And this is Peggy Curlette, 2635 Purnell Drive. These children were among the early cases to be cured by the blue baby operation. They suffered from a birth defect of the blood vessels near their heart, which prevented them from taking any exercise, even from walking more than a few steps. This procedure was such an important advance in surgery that it created a sensation throughout the world. Over 800 children have now been helped by this operation. Today, thanks to Anna and her kind, this treatment has become a standard procedure. Some 30 years ago, dogs like Anna were used to study diabetes, and it was through this research work that Dr. Banting and Dr. Best discovered insulin, the marvelous chemical that permits diabetic people to live normal lives. Here in Baltimore, in the Huffberger Laboratory of the Sinai Hospital, is the most modern development of the artificial kidney. This instrument has already saved the lives of several people. The principle of the artificial kidney was first conceived in 1913 by the late Dr. John J. Abel of the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He used dogs exclusively in developing his early model. Here are some dogs that have had artificial bladders constructed within their bodies. They are lively and healthy. Today, two people have survived this operation for the treatment of cancer of the bladder. Until medical research with dogs had shown that this operation was possible, no doctor would have been justified in performing it on a living person. The dogs that are used for medical research in Baltimore institutions receive the best of care. Only those institutions approved by the Commissioner of Health are allowed to obtain dogs from the city pound for research work. The dogs live in comfortable quarters and often become the pets of the laboratory workers. Many of them never undergo any surgical operation. Those that are operated upon receive care comparable to that given to patients. These laboratories have received approximately 900 dogs in the past 8 months from the city pound. Over 8,000 dogs, however, were destroyed uselessly at the city pound during the same period of time. Is 10% of those dogs doomed to die too great a price to pay for your health and happiness? Join with your doctor in this fight. Help him to help you, your children, and the future generations to come.
I think that's such a touching closing image, isn't it? It just warms your heart. I think it's interesting that they identify not only the patient, but their address. No, that wasn't Vivian Thomas. But interestingly, we do have another film in our collection that we just discovered on closed chest massage, in which Vivian Thomas is shown with a dog in almost the same exact pose as this young man. So it's kind of interesting. I want to show this other tobacco clip.
What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?
Tens of thousands of doctors in all branches of medicine in all parts of the country were asked that question.
What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?
The brand named most was Camel. Yes, surveys show more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette.
Smoke Camels, the cigarette so many doctors enjoy.
You know, if you were to follow a busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out for many men of medicine usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. And because they know what a pleasure it is to smoke a mild, good-tasting cigarette, they're particular about the brand they choose. In a repeated national survey, doctors in all branches of medicine, doctors in all parts of the country were asked, "What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?" Once again, the brand named most was Camel. Yes, according to this repeated nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Why not change to Camels for the next 30 days and see what a difference it makes in your smoking enjoyment? See how Camels agree with your throat. See how mild and good-tasting a cigarette can be.
Any other questions you can... Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot for coming.